Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and today our guest on Writers' Voices is Christopher Colbert. Do I have that pronounced correctly?
That or the other way is fine, too.
What's the other way?
Well, the other way is Colbert.
Colbert. Okay. Well,
I will say Stephen Colbert is a relative of mine.
Okay. All right. I was going to ask you that. Yeah. Anyway, Christopher is the former managing director of the Harvard Innovation Labs and a global speaker and advisor on the convergence between technology, innovation, and humanity. And the book that we're discussing today is Technology is Dead, The Path to a More Human Future. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Chris.
Thank you, Monica.
So this was a very brief bio that's on the back of your book, but you have done a whole lot more than that. I'm looking at your website, and you started out, you ran several companies focused on innovation and technology, including Database Marketing Corp, BeNow, which was sold to Equifax, Holland Marks. And then you left that to turn around Scholastic Corp, which is all of, you know, all of us remember Scholastic from our school days when we had the, what were those things that, you know, you had those little catalogs of books you got to.
Yeah, the book clubs.
Yes, we loved those. Everybody loved those.
They're still alive, believe it or not. They're still, that was my focus when I went there to try to sort of resuscitate that business. And they're still doing it.
I just remember as a child how exciting it was to pour through that and be able to pick out the books. And fortunately, my family were readers, and so my parents were more than, you know, that was one thing they were willing to spend money on is books. I didn't have a lot of other things, but we had books. So anyway, and then you went to Harvard. And you were the managing director of Harvard Innovation Labs. And then when you left Harvard, you've been speaking and advising organizations and countries all around the world. And now you get to talk to us.
Yay! You know, one comment about my background, which somebody said to me a bit ago, you know, you've really bounced around. And I don't think they meant it as a criticism. And I said, you know, I don't see it that way, because I think the thread of my entire career, going back to my first job out of college, which was in a hotel company, the thread of my entire career has been about observing people, you know, and trying to understand why people do what they do, why they don't do what they should do, or they shouldn't do what they do has really guided everything I've done and ultimately resulted in writing this book. And I wrote a book in 2019 titled This Is It, which is a completely different book, more of a self-help book. But the gist is the same, which is, how do we help each other better understand each other in order to navigate our lives in a more meaningful and consequential way? Whether the us is you and me as friends, or the us is our species and everything in between. I think that the lack of human understanding or increasing human understanding is the ultimate lever to increase the odds that the outcome will be beneficial for all.
All right. I'm going to write that one down. Increasing human understanding is the lever to increasing the odds that things will be more beneficial for everyone.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic quote. So
now, and by the way, you know, I got divorced 25 years ago, and sadly, and I to this day, I believe what happened in my first marriage was not a lack of love. It was a lack of understanding. And if you go to nation state stuff, you know, if you look at our politics and what's happening in the United States, I think it's a lack of understanding. I think, you know, we gloss over that, but that is fundamentally what is going on. And if we could all just start caring more about understanding what is underneath the issues, what is underneath the realities, I think we'd be much better suited to help solve the problems.
I totally agree. And in fact, whenever I think about politics, which I do quite a lot, actually, I think it's like I see these things that, in my case, the Republicans are saying about Democrats. They want, you know, they want to kill babies. They want open borders. They want, they hate America. It's like nobody wants those things, and nobody can actually believe that the other side wants those things. We all Right. want to be able to raise our families or have our friendships in peace and enjoy life. That's, we all Yeah. want a good life. I think the difference is that some people feel or are afraid that allowing somebody else to have to live life the way they want to impinges on their ability to have the life that they want.
Exactly.
And whereas Again. The other side, which I put myself on, feels that your happiness, your ability to live life your way adds to my ability to live life my way, not detracts from it.
Right, absolutely. And can you imagine if the debates and or the dialogue was stylistically was reflected what you just expressed?
If
the candidates were actually talking about the human truth of what is underlying our country's problems and showed empathy for the other versus this power game of I'm going to beat you over the head and then you're going to beat me over the head. I mean,
could somebody who did that win?
What's that?
Could a candidate who acted that way win if all the others were stayed in the status quo? I think they could.
I think they could. I mean,
but it might take a while.
Yeah, it might take a while. It might take a couple of turns. I mean, this is really the point of the book is it's like, you know, people say, well, my vote doesn't count. A vote does count. And an action counts. And you can say, well, why bother giving up drinking water in a plastic bottle? You know, climate, you know, we're screwed. So my sacrifice of convenience doesn't mean anything. And I reject that outright. That every little action is part of a movement. And if over time a candidate was communicating in that way, over time, eventually, I believe there would, and if more of us supported that kind of dialogue, that kind of perspective, over time, that would turn into a movement, and over time, we would be able to reset the equation. But if we all just throw up our hands and say, there's nothing we can do, I'm just going to keep drinking water in a plastic bottle, I think we're destined to not have this end well, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not a doomsdayer, you know. I believe in people. I believe in the power of the people. But I think we have to be honest.
When I was a kid, the idea of buying a bottle, plastic bottle of water, in a convenience store was unthought of. It was.
It's truly insane. It's insane. And, you know, now we have these hurricanes that are devastating populations, and yet if it doesn't impact us specifically, if we don't have a condominium on the west coast of Florida, we care, but we don't really care. And I think that's wild.
Yeah.
There's a disassociation between the macro realities of the world and my own individual case. And as long as my individual case, as long as I have what I need, everything else is just sort of a theoretical observation that doesn't influence my own choices or behaviors. And until we...
And it's easy to fall into that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm guilty in the sense I do everything I can. I shouldn't say I do everything. I do a lot environmentally to not be part of the problem. But you mentioned I do a lot of speaking, which means I have to travel to Singapore and Nairobi and, you know, you name it. And I get on a plane.
Yeah.
And, you know, the truth is I shouldn't be getting on that plane. So
I travel a lot, too. I get on the plane. I go back and forth from Iowa to Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I would prefer to go back and forth less, but there's reasons that I have to do it as much as I do. And, you know, I could drive it, but I don't think I in my head, I'm doing the environmental calculation. Is a single person driving that far going to have any less of an environmental impact than flying? Now, if I had a car full of people, it would be different. But if it's a single person, is it really much different?
Yeah.
And the problem is we don't actually have – it's not easy to even make that calculation, to even find the data for an average person, if you even think to make the calculation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in this book, Technology is Dead, which doesn't mean that technology isn't all around us everywhere and will continue to be. It means – well, tell us what the title means to you and why you chose it.
There are three answers to that. One is I was invited to speak at this in 2018 when I was at Harvard. I was invited to speak at the Singapore FinTech Festival, which is the largest financial technology conference in the world. They got 60,000-70,000 people to attend, and I was asked to be the keynote. And the truth is, I was asked to be the keynote because of my title, Managing Director of the Harvard Innovation Lab. So everybody's like, "Oh, I want to hear what this guy has to say." But I don't subscribe to that. So I said to the gentleman who invited me, I said, "I will only speak if I can speak on whatever I want to speak on." And he said, "What do you want to speak on?" And in a flash, I said, "The title of my talk will be Technology is Dead." And at that point, all I really knew was I wanted to talk about humanity. I wanted to talk about human first technological innovation. Ultimately, as I thought about the title, I came to realize that it's pretty appropriate that the way technology has insinuated itself into our lives, sometimes it feels like it is part of us. Like we are connected to it in a way where it's almost as if we're bionic. I was on the subway last night in Boston, and everybody in the compartment, 100% of the people were looking at their phones. There was no there was nobody looking at anybody, and there's no recognition of each other.
No conversation.
None. No hello, no good morning, no nothing. And so the thing, what I'm trying to convey is it's a tool like a hammer. It is not part of us. We are not as reliant on it as we think we are. And the question is, so it's dead, it's inanimate. And the question is, are we using the tool effectively, where effectively is not simply productivity, you know, the ability to conduct multiple transactions in a moment or a day. Effective is the tool contributing to a more meaningful life, a life of well-being, a life of fulfillment, a life of happiness, are we using the tool the right way? And I think more and more, as I talk around the world on the topic, people are realizing the answer is not really. No.
Yeah. In your book is structured in several sections. Mm-hmm. So the first section is sort of like how we got here.
Yeah, the thing I would, I qualify is I am not, I'm not an academic, this book is not 10, 15 years of research. This is a lifetime of observation and the last two or three years of trying to consolidate or synthesize my observations into a cogent arc of a story. And so the first part of the book is an observational history of technology, the evolution of technology and innovation more broadly. The second part of the book is titled The Unintended Consequences, which is this idea that because of our lack of human understanding or human consideration, much of the technologies that have come into our world, while they've done really positive things, in many cases, they brought with them unintended consequences. And some of those unintended consequences, and they're negative unintended consequences. Some of those consequences are very individual, very personal, and some of those unintended consequences are very systemic, macro unintended consequences. Climate is arguably the poster child. So the second section is all about the macro unintended consequences. Climate, future pandemics, negative population growth, cyber terrorism, et cetera. And then the third section is titled The Humanist Revolution. And this is my attempt at a quote unquote solution. So what do we do about the unintended consequences? And more importantly, what do we do to change the trajectory, the overall trajectory of how we approach innovation and technology and frankly, each other? And so in The Humanist Revolution, I break it down into what could we do systemically, where we start with a reset of intentions as a species. We look at the governing entities, we refashion those entities, we refashion the systems that underpin society, et cetera, et cetera. Again, an observational view. It's not 15 years of research to inform this stuff. And then the last chapter in the book before the epilogue is changing the ways of us, because fundamentally, this is about us. You know, we are not in abeyance to technology. It should be in abeyance to us. And the question at an individual level, are each of us taking the actions and making the decisions and exhibiting the behaviors to ensure that the application of technology, present and future, is ultimately beneficial to humanity versus problematic?
And of course, in the first chapter or the first section, you talk about how resistant humans are to changing themselves. So we start with the problem and we end up with the solution, which is circles back to the problem.
Yeah, and this goes back to the point about climate and the hurricanes.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't, you know, I've been accused of being the master of sort of pithy platitudes. But one of my platitudes is, if we don't feel it, we're not inclined to change it. And feeling, you know, we are emotional creatures, right? And we pretend to be hyper-rational, but we're pretty damn emotional. I also think we're remarkably primal. Like, I really am not sure we've evolved that much from Homo sapien, whatever, way back when. But if we don't feel the pain, we're not going to do anything about it. And I use my own background, my divorce, you know, scenario 25 years ago. I was kind of a broken person and not really willing to do much about it. And then three things happened over the course of 6 months that created sufficient pain, not physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain, whatever, that I finally one day woke up and said, I have to change my behavior. I have to do the work to get to the other side of this thing. And that's the problem. Like, until the water is lapping at our door, I think a lot of us are not inclined to change anything.
Well, it's like with addicts, they say they have to hit rock bottom.
Yeah. Well, in my first book, This Is It, which is, as I said, self-help, sort of a memoir of my own journey of getting to the other side. I refer to that as I wish upon everybody acceptable rock bottom. Now, the difference between rock bottom and acceptable rock bottom is rock bottom, you know, per what you said, Monica, is I'm on a sidewalk passed out with a needle in my arm.
Yeah. Like that, yeah.
You know, and destitute. To me, acceptable rock bottom is, we just can't take it anymore. You know, whatever it is, we are just sick and tired of being the way we are. We're sick and tired of the circumstance of our community. We're sick and tired of the loss and devastation attached to climate. We're just sick and tired of it to the point where we are feeling so angry or so upset that we decide then and there to do something really material about it. But until we reach that tipping point, I think most of us, and this was true for me for the first 40 years of my life, I knew I was not in good shape. And I wasn't willing to do it. I just let and it ended up, you know, destroying my marriage and separating me from my three kids. And it came at a huge cost.
Did you catch it in time to be able to heal the rift with your kids?
I did, thank God. And now, you know, they know my whole story. They know the whole thing. They read my first book. I have a wonderful relationship with all three of them. But the first, you know, 15 years of their life, it was not good. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Christopher Colbert, author of Technology is Dead, The Path to a More Human Future. So, Chris, as I was reading through, I took a few notes about, there's just so much in here. There's so many things that that we could talk the whole hour just about one or two points. But when early on you're talking about technology and the how it was either increasing the speed of things or the duration, and how speed mm-hmm. has won out in our technology development over duration. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, it's a really, again, this is a book of observations, you know, and, you know, probably everything I write in here can and maybe should be challenged. But I do believe if you contemplate what is the motivations behind all the innovations, beginning with fire and the wheel, and the gist of it has really been about productivity, this presumption that more productivity is always better. And then at some point, productivity became about speed to deliverable, speed to accomplishment, speed to outcome. And, you know, on the face of it, that makes perfect sense. And there's a presumption, has been true for centuries, if not thousands of years, that productivity is the way to make everything better. That economic productivity specifically, a rising tide will lift all boats, that the more wealth we create for our nation, the more wealth to be shared, and that will enable only good things to happen. But I think the flaw in that is it's like a myopic view, and it says the only thing that matters is wealth, and that somehow magically, as the wealth of a nation grows, it will be appropriately distributed so everybody in the nation will benefit. And the data actually doesn't support that at all. And it actually is the opposite. It turns out what that does is it creates division, and it creates stratification, and it creates a scenario where 1% of the population controls 70% of the wealth or something. But the real point is speed as the motivator for innovation, and particularly technological innovation, is a myopic intention, and that we as a species should take a step back and say, shouldn't the intention of innovation be more dimensional than that? Shouldn't it look at the truth of humans, back to my human understanding point, and think it through in terms of how this innovation might both benefit us, but also how it might prey on our vulnerabilities, prey on our maybe unhealthy predilections? And shouldn't we make sure that this thing, whatever this thing is we're attempting to build, will be, if not wholly positive, you know, 95 or 99% positive. But the real point is we need a different intention for innovation, for technology, and for society. GDP is the measure of America. Is a myopic measure.
I absolutely agree. Do you remember the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad years ago?
Yeah.
I disliked that book a lot because to me it was like the only measure of whether you're a good dad is if you're making a lot of money and passing on good money tips. You know, it's the poor dad was spending time with his kid, and so he was not as good a dad. It's like it was so backwards to me.
I think that's right. And I just everything is more dimensional than we want to believe it is. You know, it's like the argument with your significant other or your child. Like we try to make it a flat interaction, meaning there's just it's one dimension of me against one dimension of me. And like, there's a lot more going on here.
Of course,
happiness.
Yeah, the problem is it's hard to measure other things as easily as we can measure dollars.
For sure. But that's classically human. We're going to go to the simple place. Well, we can measure GDP, therefore that becomes the measure.
Yeah.
You're like, what?
So isn't there now a happiness index?
Yeah. So and I write about this in the book that this, you know, the solution part of the book, section three or part three, begins with, I think the title of the chapter is beginning with the end in mind, which is resetting the outcome that we're after for our species. And I talk about moving from economic growth, GDP, to well-being or happiness. And there are a bunch of organizations, including the UN, that is really trying to sort of reconfigure how we measure the progress of our humanity. You know, one of the ones that I really like, it's a little wonky, and I know I write about it a little bit in the book. I think it'd be hard to get universal acceptance. But the belief that underneath well-being is the concept of latitude, which is a fancy way of saying freedom. If every human on the planet had the freedom to realize his or her potential, and that freedom presumes, you know, Maslowian needs are being met of safety and shelter and food and water. But if all of us felt freedom to realize who we are and the wonder of who we are, that would be one hell of an intention. And it becomes a really helpful guiding light for everything we do, from policies to systems design, you know, to whatever. The challenge, I think, in getting a universal reset of intention is there is no universal or global entity with the capacity or power or authority to make that happen. Plus, we still are fighting this contradiction of a globalized society still built on a nationalistic framework.
Yeah.
I mean, look at how we responded to the pandemic, which is a global threat. It's not a national threat, it's a global threat. But we couldn't figure out how to create a global response because of nationalistic, you know, legacy thinking.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. is going to do what the U.S. is, you know, China's going to do what China does. You're like, but people, this is, the COVID did not acknowledge borders. You know, like,
no, exactly. Exactly. And
climate,
you know, I'm going to throw this in. Neither does God.
Right. I don't think that's inappropriate. I think that's exactly right. I write about it, and I say this to people all the time. I was out to breakfast with a really dear friend of mine, a guy named Mark Baker, who's a rabbi, and he's the head of Combined Jewish Philanthropies here in Boston. And we were talking about the situation in the Middle East. And I said, you know, I just don't subscribe to borders. I think it's a false, I know it's a false construct. It's a force construct. It was designed for power. Power and status created the division between peoples. And why do we have to maintain that? And I know that's radical thinking and impractical, and you have to have borders and whatever, but you know, the immigrants coming from Central America trying to find their way into America, they're our brothers and sisters.
I totally agree. And there's so much, I mean, we could get so much into that whole thing about, first of all, what America's done to contribute to the causes of them wanting to leave, and the fact that nobody leaves their country and takes that kind of journey unless they're really forced to, unless they have no other option. And yeah, and they people are literally, I was in Mexico, I do business in Mexico, and I got this direct, people are literally riding on the tops of trains across Mexico to try, you know, and dying, you know, from falling off. And I can remember as like 5 years old thinking that that's how you rode on a train, was riding on the top, because I had some picture book that had like animals or something on the tops of trains. But it, but, you know, eventually I learned that that's not actually how you're supposed to ride on trains. And it's so there's that. And then there's the issue that I was thinking about this morning. There's a lot of small towns in states like Iowa and other places that would be dying without the immigrant population and will die if we close off immigration.
Well, let me just interject there. I write about in the book, one of the unintended consequences of technology is negative population growth.
Right.
And it's a very real issue for the Western world, and with Italy as a poster child. It's also an issue in Asia. Japan is a poster child. Japan's population by 2100 will be cut in half, and of the remaining people, roughly 70% will be over the age of 70. Now, can you imagine what that does to an economy where 70% of your population isn't really capable of working, and or there are no people to do labor? And the irony to me is the solution, which I talk about in the book, is immigration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome these people. And you know, the past president, whose name we shall not speak, you know, wants to remove 22 million immigrants from this country. And
who does he expect's going to do that work?
I don't know.
It's hard enough. I'm a business person, and it's hard enough to find employees now for the kind of manual labor.
Yeah, and I know you agree with me. I think the thing that just, it makes me almost nauseous is this idea that the people that aren't like us are less than us.
I know.
What is that?
I know. And I, you know, I have to be very grateful to my parents who were, and my mother still is, conservative Republican, but never believed that, never taught us that. In fact, my mother pulls out this song every time the family gets together. It was, I think it was the Finnish kind of national song, and it's a song about how people in every other country love their children too and want the best for their children too.
Yeah, it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
Wait, is your mother Finnish?
She is not, but she was a music teacher, and she loves this song. I can't remember. I should remember the name of it since I've sung it with her so many times, but I'm forgetting at the moment. So
that's, you know, what we're talking about is really, it goes back to human understanding, that we have chosen not to understand that that immigrants are humans too. We've chosen not to understand why we feel, some percentage of us feel so angry about immigration. And the other thing that's ironic about the anti-immigration movement in the United States is we're all immigrants. All of
Absolutely.
Us came from other places, and we seem to have forgotten that. Not owning the forces within us that are causing us to take these extreme views that are so profoundly inhuman.
They seem to be based on fear.
Yes, for sure.
Usually. And so how do you help people get past that fear?
Well, I think it goes back to the candidate we both want to run for office. I think we have to have leadership that talks about things like fear, and talks about courage, and talks about sacrifice, and trading self-interest for selflessness, and the importance of being one, and you know, I am not a religious person, but I believe the secularization of society has hurt us. I think we no longer have a place to go to remind ourselves of our collective responsibility and our collective relationship, you know?
Yes, I understand you saying that, but also, like, I'm going to read a sentence from your book. The subjugation of the different by the dominant has been a constant in the history of the world. So yes. Is it any different now, really? Has the secularization made it any worse?
I don't know, but I just, again, I didn't grow up in a religious family, but I do believe words matter. And I think if decades ago, some percentage of humans were in an environment on a regular basis and the words being imparted were about loving thy neighbor and caring for the other, and there was a sense of community beyond, you know, living in a condo building, I have to believe that had some influence on behavior. I'm not saying it was perfect.
It wasn't always a good influence, though.
Yeah, what's that?
religion did not always have that influence. It often had the opposite influence.
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases it had the opposite. It was a bad thing. But I'm trying to separate the bad stuff from maybe there was some good stuff. And again, I'm not saying
I totally
religion
agree.
Is the answer.
I guess
what I'm really trying to say is I think the collective conversation has been replaced by what I call in the book hyper-individualization. Like very, very little consideration of the person next to me.
Right. The individual, our Second Amendment fight is a prime example of this. It's like, is the right to own any weapon that you want more important than other people's lives?
Right. or the ability to say whatever it is you want and have that broadcast to the world, even if it's an outright lie, knowing that some percentage of the world will think it's the truth.
So I do want you to read a little bit, but we're going to run out of time, but I do also want to talk a little bit about, you talk about these three essential levers of, what are they the levers of? It was on page 20. Humankind's three essential levers, capital, education, and healthcare. Why do you choose those three, and what do you actually mean by those as levers? So it says the final shift is democratization, or the increased ability of more people across the planet to access humankind's three essential levers, capital, education, and healthcare. So levers able to achieve a better life. Is that?
It's just very basic, which is, you know, in order to navigate a life, to realize the potential of a life, what are the fundamental resources any human needs? And you need money at some level. I'm not saying I agree with that, but you do need money. You need education. I was talking yesterday with somebody about the loss of critical thinking as a capacity among people. That's partly an educational issue. And then you need healthcare. You need the ability to stay alive. You need the ability to stay healthy. And those are just the building blocks what any human needs to realize the potential of their life. So that's really the point there.
So let's talk a little bit about education, which you
I
do
love
get
that
into. You do get into quite a bit in the book. And I happen to be on the this show will be broadcast on the station at Maharishi International University, which is our local university, private university here that is part of the Transcendental Meditation Movement. And I'm actually part of a steering committee looking at the next 5 years for the university.
Oh, wow.
And like many other small private universities, there's a lot of challenges, right now. It's facing a lot of challenges. I'm wondering, is the college experience that was pretty much the same for my mother's generation, my kids' generation, maybe my grandkids who are teenagers now may have a similar experience, but is that going away? Is that going to be completely different in future generations? The idea of going to a campus, you know, having these semesters of courses taught a certain way, mostly in person, is that gone by the wayside?
So, I mean, we could have a whole other show on this topic. Let me start with the system called education, K through 12, through you know, college, university, second, you know, master's program. I think is struggling in part because the intention, I go back to my intention thing. What is the intention of the system? And I think the principal intention of the system is productivity, is let's get these kids educated so they can go out and get a job. And I think that's the wrong intention. That's a piece of the intention. We need to prepare them for the world for sure, and the ability to like make money, I suppose. But if the intention was more dimensional, that was more human, focused on imbuing students with the skills and the mindsets and behaviors they need, not just to get a job, but to live a life of meaning, to be able to adapt to what will be inevitably changing conditions, to be more responsive to environmental stimuli, to understand what happiness is, to understand, you know, how to navigate every aspect of life, then that system has real value. That system is central to the species, not just survival, but thriving. But the intention of the current system, not just higher ed, is not anywhere close to that. I mean, I worked at Harvard for 5 years, and the intention of that system, well, I'll tell you an anecdote. I went and met with when I first got to Harvard, I went and met with each of the deans of the 12 schools at Harvard. So HBS, government, design, law, medical, whatever. And I met with a dean who was the head of Harvard College at the time. I forget his name. And I, in my coffee with him, I talked about intentionality. And he slaps his desk, literally. He slaps his hand on his desk and he says, "I can't believe we're having this conversation. Not 3 days ago, I was with the senior faculty of Harvard College discussing that very issue. And the question for them was, what is the intention of a Harvard College education?" And Monica, I thought to myself, oh my God, this school has been in business since 1641. And they're just now asking the question of what is the intention? So if higher education does not reset the intention to be a more real world 21st century technology riddled environment where change is the course of the day, if they do not do that, I do not believe that 50 years from now, I think, you know, you've seen the data about how many schools are going out of business, the smaller liberal arts colleges. I mean, Boston has a ton of schools. We've lost several in the last 5 years. I think that trend will continue. I think probably in 50 years, you know, the number of traditional colleges, universities will probably be down by a third. I think what's funny about it, though, the pace of change would be faster if we were all not creatures of the environment. So even though I know that higher education is flawed, the intention is wrong, the value, frankly, it's just not there. You know, my daughter went to NYU. It was almost $85,000 a year. That was 10 years ago. Now it's probably $100,000. So $400,000 for her to go up. You know, But the funny thing is, if you fast forward, if she was now ready to go to college, you said, Chris, knowing everything you know about higher education, would you have Annie go to college, to go to NYU or wherever? I would still probably say yes.
Yeah.
Because I'm a product of that. So by
I know.
By saying no, I'm basically saying the thing that helped create me is flawed. Which becomes very personal. Like, I'm basically saying that the ground that I stand on is not as solid as it appears to be because.
We've always done things has a lot of momentum. And it's true with K through 12 too. You know, the idea of putting 25 kids in a room, sitting at desks with. Now it is changing a lot. A lot's being done on their tablets, and you know, it's not so much the teacher writing on the board and giving instruction one that way. It can be more maybe individualized with the tablets. So it is changing, but it's still all these kids in a classroom all day.
Yeah, I mean it's brutally hard. You know, the same is true for our healthcare system in the United States. Like, we all recognize it's kind of broken.
Yeah.
And so why can't we change it? And because legacy institutions that have embedded themselves in the way we live, the way we work, they're legacy for a reason. The word I use is calcified. You know, they're so. Or is it sclerotic, like they're just, and so nobody can get their head around how do you blow up a system like that and remake it? And you know, the truth is you can't. Although, funny anecdote, you mentioned my podcast, I had a podcast titled Insert Human that I did during COVID for a couple of years. And I had all these really interesting people on the show to talk about how they're trying to bring more human understanding into their vocation. And I interviewed this guy named David Grinspoon, who was an astrobiologist who worked for NASA and the Japanese Space Agency. And David's responsibility was to figure out how to colonize outer space, even though colonization is no longer. How to colonize outer space without bringing the bad part of humanity.
Good luck with that.
But my point is, you know, David can imagine going to Mars and creating a brand new healthcare system or a brand new education system. But doing that work here, it's just so mucky, you know?
Yes, yes.
And then the last thing I'll say about the question about, you know, will people still be going to college and university the way it's configured today. I think once there is a better mousetrap, you know, and I think we haven't figured out what the better mousetrap is. I actually am on the board of an organization called School of Humanity in Dubai, and they have reinvented high school. It's primarily online, but they're marching towards sort of a hybrid delivery model. But they've reset the intention around whole human ability, mindset, behavior stuff. They've reset the modality of teaching. It's all project-based, real-world problem assignments, integrated curriculum, so you don't just do math here, you know, English here, whatever. My point is, I think in 10 or 20 years, there will be meaningful alternatives for parents to consider or students to consider, it's certainly in high school, but definitely at a higher ed, college, university level.
Well, one of the things I also think about was, like, when I was a kid, everybody went to public school. Everyone in your whole town went to the same school. And now there's a lot more, it's a little fractured with all the homeschooling and so forth. And you mentioned about secularization, you know, where you didn't have people going and getting this message, this community message. I think we're also losing some of that community message that kids got in all going to the same school. And
I agree with that.
And that's part of what's split us apart.
Yeah,
And
I think that's true too. I think that's true.
But the idea of public schools that every kid went to was a pretty brief moment in history.
Yeah, it was.
So who knows what's next? So Chris, before we run out of time, can you just read a little bit from the book Technology is Dead?
Sure. I'm actually just going to read the intro because I think it does a pretty good job of capturing what the book's
Great.
about, and also hopefully motivate some of your listeners to want to read it. So here we go. Contrary to what the title might suggest, this is not a book about technology. This is a book about being more human. Technology, after all, and its seemingly infinite manifestations, remains a human project responsible for many of the ways we experience the world, how we live, work, and exist. And yet, technology itself is dead. It is inanimate. It is inhuman. It has no value until its capacities are constructively linked to the truth of our humanity and the positive whole human outcomes we seek for ourselves, for future generations, and for the planet we rely on. Over the last 50 years, we have allowed a troubling disconnection, a gap to appear. Technology is now stewarding our lives instead of us stewarding it, resulting in a myriad of unintended, problematic, and even existential consequences. We must close the gap. And given the rapid advances of artificial intelligence, we don't have time to waste. We need to act now to establish a new order, one that puts human understanding and shared well-being first. My hope is that our collective effort will become a sort of humanist revolution, with millions standing up to fight, not with arms, but with persistent voices, shared sacrifices, courageous decisions, and model behaviors of what it means to be human. And I go on and on and on, but that's the gist.
Thank you. That was Christopher Colbert reading from The Path, or Technology is Dead, The Path to a More Human Future. And one of the other thing, oh, there's so much more in here. There, you talk about this idea of how war, even war, has changed from something that was very binary, kind of win lose, winner take all kind of thing, to a non-total war. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Again, observation. This is not an academic endeavor. This was an observational endeavor of how we got to where we are and what we could do about it. So the observation is we are a warring creature. We've been warring since we were, hitting each other over the head with clubs. And the history of war is, as you said, as a binary proposition, which is, the redcoats are arriving and the battles are either won or lost, and the war is either won or lost. And that's what we've known for centuries, thousands of years. Now, however, the threats that we face, the enemies that we face, it's not the war ta is no longer binary. These enemies are not vanquishable. They are not visible. They do not respect borders. And winning is not binary. It's not, we're not going to defeat climate. We're not going to defeat pandemics. We're not going to defeat cyber terrorism. So we have to get okay with A, these enemies are not vanquishable completely. B, they're global, so we have to collaborate across countries to address them. And C, remediation, trying to mitigate the consequences of these enemies is part one, but the other part is prevention, which is how do we get ahead of these enemies? And I think the conversations about AI is an attempt to do that. Like, what are the guardrails and the guiding lights around how we unleash artificial intelligence so that we are not creating or spawning a whole other set of existential threats? So that's the point there.
Yes. And at the same time, we're still warring against one another, too.
Which, I mean, it's kind of like immigration. Like, what are we doing here, people?
Well, it's this, you talk about the bias being kind of in our code, And one of the main biases is this poll thinking. You want to describe that?
Yeah, it's a simple, we seek the simple. Like our capacity to process a lot of complexity constantly is pretty limited. So what we do to make ourselves feel better is we distill really complicated propositions down to simple, typically emotionally charged places. You know, East versus West, Democrat versus Republican, your team versus my team, whatever. And none of it is really true. None of it is really reflective of what is going on. I mean, the polls of Americans versus other people, those are false constructs. We're all just people. We all have, you know, yeah. To your earlier point, we all have children. We all care about our children. We all have hearts. We all have brains. We all want the best for ourselves, whatever. I don't know. But we force these false constructs. And you know, I mean, think about how many Americans are going to vote on in whatever it is, 3 weeks, who actually don't know much in the way of what their candidate represents, you know?
In terms of policy,
oh,
yeah.
God,
yeah.
No.
They only know what they represent in terms of image.
A simple view, you know, a
yeah.
simple view. Well,
yeah,
she's a Democrat. Therefore, he's a
celebrity.
I was going to say a big mouth, but he's a celebrity. Like it's those, that is the, you know, here's another one that drives me crazy. What we're talking about happens at cocktail parties. So you walk into a party, a room full of 30 people, and you immediately start labeling everybody you see. You do. And if there's somebody from India in the corner, you're like, okay, that's an Indian person. And you,
yeah.
And they're like, none of that is true. What is true is we're all the same.
Unfortunately, it's hard to convince everybody of that.
I know.
And also, unfortunately, we're out of time.
I know.
So we always end with the quote, and I'm going to read a quote from chapter 2 of your book from Isaac Asimov. The saddest aspect of life right now is that science gathers knowledge faster than society gathers wisdom. And that's kind of the crux of the matter, isn't it?
Yeah, and if I can just add to that really quickly, I think obtaining wisdom is a choice. It's, you know, certainly it has something to do with IQ, but I think all of us have sufficient IQ to become wiser. And I think if we all, this is the point of the revolution, if we all just tried a little harder to understand ourselves, to understand our others, whether they're significant others, friends, strangers, the person across the aisle, the person in the voting booth next to you, that is the wisdom we need, that level of understanding.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Chris.
Thank you for the work that you do, and I really, really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit.
Me too, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.